Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, doing internet, it is Monday, August 13th, and you are listening to Waypoint Radio, episode 178. I am your host, not Austin Walker today, because he is taking a much-needed vacation. So I'm Danielle Riendo, and joining me today are Patrick Klepek.
I don't believe he's actually taking a vacation. I don't. When Austin's definition of a vacation is not what any of us consider a vacation. So Austin's going to write a book this week.
Probably.
I wrote a book. I made 3 podcasts. Great vacation.
Yeah. You're not wrong in the slightest. I think you're absolutely right. Also joining us not on vacation is Natalie Watson.
Hi.
And also not on vacation, Rob Zachney.
Though I wish I were.
Yeah. I think we all do. That's right. You're
going
to be having a couple days.
I'm going to the mountains. I'm going to California to visit my family. And then I'm going to go to Sequoia National Park for a few days.
Just cut those fuckers
down.
Which
I'm really excited about. Yeah.
Whoa.
Wow.
Start logging.
Aggressive.
Excuse me?
Did a Sequoia do something to you? Also, I don't like the way that word comes out of my mouth.
Ooh. Sequoia.
Sequoia sounds like, I don't know. Sounds like a term that we're not supposed to say anymore in 2018.
It's definitely got a mouthfeel to it.
Sequoia, I'm going to say Sequoia, so I'm going to get an email that's like, hey, I don't think you understand like the origin of that word.
I like Sequoia, personally. I like the way it feels in me mouth.
You know,
Sequoia.
Sometimes you like a Sequoia in your mouth, and that's,
That's what I'm doing on my trip.
That's the podcast.
Yeah, please don't put a tree in your mouth. My daughter does that all the time. Banned for life from
Sequoia National.
Don't do that to the trees, please.
I won't. I have a lot of respect for those trees. Those are our ancestors.
You know, they're good trees. That's a beautiful place, and I'm very excited for you. It's interesting because Kato just came back, I think, from Sequoia, I think he was in
Colorado.
He went out west to the woods as well, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, just all of us making these, you know, introspective trips out to the woods to think about ourselves. To recenter, be with the trees, put a tree in your mouth, who knows?
I slept in my daughter's crib this morning, or yesterday, so she would sleep another hour. Is that the equivalent? Just getting down into a crib on the floor and just scrunching into a ball and just pretending that you're going to sleep for another 45 minutes?
You are such a little man.
The crib is tinier.
Oh, man.
My daughter, my wife woke up feeling like she was coming out with a cold.
Oh no!
I was trying to buy her some time so she could sleep a little longer. But my daughter's been waking up. She usually wakes up like 7:30, and which is really late for a kid her age. But she's been getting up at 6 lately, and I didn't realize that my wife was going to feel ill, so I stayed out at my friend's around the block like a little later than I would have responsibly have come home, and I just stared at my daughter when she woke up. She's like, gesturing that she wanted to get out. And I was like, but what if I climbed in there? Would you go back to sleep? She looked at me and she nodded. And I said, okay. And I went and grabbed 3 pacifiers. So she had 5. I was like, here's all of the pacifiers. And I'm going to lay down here. And
it's like the toddler equivalent of like showing up with a carton of cigs. Just being like, oh, kiddo, we're having a classic night.
Yeah, and it was one of those. You have one of those sleeps where when I woke up from it, I was convinced that I actually didn't sleep. That I just like laid there and was just trying to like buy my wife time. And I was like, all right, well, that was only like 10 minutes. And then I got up and it was an hour and a half. And I was like, that's not how time works. But apparently,
wow,
that's a very wholesome image.
I'll send you a copy of the image. I took a photo from our camera. I'll send it to our Discord while I pass this conversation.
Please.
Very good. Very good. I like that. That sounds kind of nice, you know. This isn't nearly as cute. But I've been spooning with my dog every night because I'm like, I don't know, he's had some emotional difficulties lately, my little dog Drakey. And aww. So we spoon every single night now, and it's very cute. Although he gets very upset if, like, I don't want to spoon with him that night. He's, like, he's a very needy boy, you know. And he'll try. He's a very tiny dog, but I'm doing a gesture, and I know this isn't great for radio, but he will try to spoon me. Like, he'll stretch out as much as possible and, like, try to wrap himself around me, which is very... He is half Chihuahua, so to give you a sense of his size. But, yeah, that's a good... I gotta say, Patrick, good, very good.
Aww. Yeah, I posted the photo in the chat.
Yeah,
that's an extremely cute picture.
It does not quite depict the
black and white is a little unsettling, but otherwise,
it is very cute.
I don't know what it is about black and white. It's like weird security cam footage. Like, I shouldn't be seeing this. Why do I have access to this?
Wholesome photo captured on security. You know, sometimes.
Doesn't quite convey the level of anxiety in, like, my lower back area that I was feeling at the time, but I fell asleep and just ignored it. So
yeah,
very cute.
See, in the paranormal activity version of this, like, this is the picture the family wakes up to, like, the next day, and are like, "Who is that?"
Oh no!
My version of that was I slept on the couch. So that my wife could have the full, you know, because you're sick, you know, you don't want to, like, touch other people. And I honestly didn't want her touching me. I didn't want to get
the
sick.
The truth comes
you know?
Out.
Yeah.
And so she's a real light sleeper. And I can sleep through a thunderstorm. Like, it takes a lot to wake me up. And so I was going to sleep on the couch so that the moment I heard my daughter in the morning, I'd wake up and I could go take care of it without her waking up my kid. But I don't know what I did, but I got up at, like, 3 or 4 in the morning, and I must have, like, hit my foot against something.
Ouch.
So I get up to go to the bathroom. Well, I didn't really realize what happened, but I come back, and all of a sudden, like, I feel like I stepped in some liquid on the floor.
I'm
like,
no.
Must be some water or something that, like, which is true. Like, frequently there are liquids all over the ground because of a kid. And I look down, and it's just, oh, that is just a trail of blood.
Oh, my God. What is wrong with you?
What happened? And, like, I retraced my steps. I'm cleaning up the blood along the way. I'm looking at my foot, and it's just got a cut on the top of, like, my pinky toe. But there's no sharp objects anywhere.
Oh, no.
So.
Mysterious.
I don't know. It was not great, though. 3 in the morning, like.
It's not good.
A slight drunken haze, like, just cleaning up blood off the floor.
What is this wetness around me?
Yeah. So the phrase that goes through your head, what is this wetness around me? Like, no good story goes from there. That premise is not great.
Never.
No, definitely not.
Never good. I guess speaking of that wetness around me.
Gross.
Yeah, speaking of Drake.
I wasn't going to go there, but, you know, sometimes when you're on a date and you have a date over and your dog starts throwing up, it ain't the best. It's just not the best thing.
Well, that's the true test, is, like, can that person...
How cool is this person?
How chill is this person going to be with my lifestyle? Are you cool with doggy bomb?
It's like, this is really a romantic mood that my dog... And my dog does, like, he's dramatic when he feels ill. I'm just going to say that. There is a song and a dance element to Drake becoming physically ill that is, like... It's a little bit funny. I feel bad for him. I'm like, oh, poor buddy. But he, like, walks around. He does a whole ritual. It's very paranormal activity. I think that's maybe the way to go with that.
Quick possession.
You know, we should talk about We Happy Few, because otherwise I'll keep talking about how gross my dog is, and nobody wants to hear that. So... We Happy Few. It's a game that, Patrick, you wrote a sort of an impressions piece about it last week. It was not the happiest experience. You were not taking your joy while you were playing this game. I've been playing it myself, too, but I want to hear a little bit about what your experience was like with it.
Yeah, well, so maybe to set the game up a little bit, like, people's impression of We Happy Few, like, mine may have been, like, largely fueled by the marketing around the game. Mm-hmm. Specifically, it had a trailer a couple of years back at Microsoft's press event, press conference, whatever we're calling these things these days, that depicted a very, like, Bioshock-y, psychedelic, British... sort of like first-person, like, action-adventure game sort of thing. Like, you looked at it and you're like, oh, I just get a Bioshock-y vibe from this. And that, like, had a very – it had a big impression on a lot of people. But the moment you did any research about the game, because I think around that time that that trailer debuted, the game was going into game preview on Xbox and was going into early access on Steam. Well, the reality was – that it was a very narrative-light game, but it was actually meant to be a roguelike experience in which, like, the what you were seeing in the trailer about, like, this you know, sort of alternate reality where people are – the city or society is taking pills to cope with not wanting to remember elements of their past, which, as a premise, has all sorts of problems that are probably not even worth getting into. We'll just accept its premise on its own. It's just the kind of the environmental setting for it. And it's not something that the game itself was going to sort of like deeply engage with. It was not going to be a meticulously crafted, sort of like hold your hand through this amazing story, or just a story sort of experience that, like, I think is sort of like a defining trait of like the Bioshock, like, subgenre of the immersive sim, genre. Basically because of that response, they spent 2 years, like, working on the roguelike part, but also, like, trying to build a version of the game that people then popped into their heads as the game that they wanted. And I believe that ended up being sort of a flawed foundation to build a game that, like, shows itself in the product that came out of Early Access last week. It's now available on PS4. It had been in Early Access on Xbox and PC, but now it's on all three platforms. And it has a sort of a much more structured game where you're taking in control of three different characters, playing through three different arcs. I only made it through a portion of the first one because I sort of hit a point where I was just so deeply not enjoying the experience that the parts that I was enjoying weren't enough of a carrot to keep putting up with the other parts. And at the root of the things I was having trouble with were, like, sort of the survivalist, roguelike-y elements that were still there. That I found to be a hindrance to my ability to find the story-based stuff. And on top of that, a lot of glitches that were not quite game-breaking, but, like, about as close to the line as you can get, in a way that really infuriated, like, sort of my sense of progress and any enjoyment I was having sort of engaging with the systems of the story or the setting. And so it was, a deeply sort of frustrating experience all around because I really liked the aesthetic. And in some ways, I was curious about where the story was going, but I found that the amount of obstacles in my way were just created a wall too high for me to continue climbing. And I think a lot of that was rooted in having to use elements of a game that just were not meant for the game they were building here. And it just ended up really holding, you know, We Happy Few back in a way that I found to be just kind of insurmountable.
I'm curious if basically the marketing plan for this game or, you know, basically putting together an amazing trailer that I think really did grab a lot of people and made them want, you know, the elements you're talking about. I wonder if that actually kind of screwed them in a way, like, you know, setting up expectations for something that this game was not going to be. And then they spent years, as you said, kind of grafting different, maybe possibly disparate elements together. I actually really do wonder if this is a question of that actually kind of coming out and biting them in the ass a little bit.
Yeah, probably to some degree. I mean, I want to make clear, I don't think they were being meaningfully deceptive. I don't think a case of a developer being like, haha, like, we're going to promise people this type of game and deliver them another. I think it's the case that the trailer they built, like, ended up, like, you know, putting up a signal to a lot of people that they thought it was this type of game. But you go and did any research, looked at the game page, watched any gameplay footage, like, it was very much this. They were not pitching, like, a narrative-heavy immersive sim in that way. And so I want to just make it clear that, you know, the developers are compulsion, like, this is not something they were doing to be deliberately misleading. I just think it was one of those instances where a trailer dropped into people's heads, like, oh, this could be really interesting. And then the developers thought, well, maybe we can try and service both. Like, maybe we can find a way to make both of these work. And, you know, it's like the survival, so it's not a roguelike anymore. There's no permadeath. There's basically zero consequence to dying. the survival elements that are left over, which involve like thirst and hunger and sleep, they all they do is just sort of cap your stats in different ways. So it's like you just have less stamina if you're hungry or tired. And in addition to that, the way the sort of like the pill popping, the joy that is like sort of rooted in the philosophy of this society, based on different parts of the world that you're in, you may have to interact with joy. And so people can tell if you're not on joy. And so when you are on joy, you're kind of like happy-go-lucky, like your arms swing back and forth. Like it's a kind of a cute animation that is in contrast to like what is very clearly like very like dark and nefarious reasons that people are participating in this to begin with. As you have the door, the joy ticks down, and it's not like, oh, you take a joy pill and like you're good for like an hour. Like it's not, it's something you have to actively monitor. Where within 5 minutes, you're going to have to find another joy dispensary. And if you don't happen to have spare joy pills, and for some reason the game doesn't let you just grab joy pills from the dispensaries, you can only take one at a time. And I had not found whatever crafting option there was to build more joy on my own. It meant that, okay, well, if it was taking me a while to find like the door I needed to get into to advance this quest, well, okay, maybe 3 minutes in, I'm gonna have to go and find a joy dispenser. And oh no, you can't run, because if you run, you look suspicious. And so you have to then map in your head, I have to make sure I have enough time to walk to the dispensary, because if you then are, your joy meter goes all the way down, you're going to be a downer. And then people notice that and they will turn on you. And it's not a case where like, oh geez, like you've got a couple of minutes of being a downer before people start. It's like almost instantaneous where like meter goes away, you're seen as a downer, and then they don't just hound you or like talk to you, like they just beat you to death. And then you have to like respawn into the game and hopefully start over. And so in addition to that, every time you take a joy pill, you're filling up an overdose meter. And so if you just happen to be like mid mission and then like, oh, you take some joy, oh well, now I've overdosed. And when I've overdosed, like it makes everyone really suspicious of me, which means then they're going to kill me. And like, it's just the parts where I the survivalist stuff that could be potentially interesting worked so at odds with the ability to like what I usually imagine is the appeal for these games, at least for me, is like taking your time, like looking through all the drawers, like being meticulous and slow and deliberate. And all of these survival stuff is like, no, like you need to be doing da 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 da. And that doesn't really work, especially in the more condensed urban sort of city areas where there are so many things that you want to stop and look at, but you are discouraged from doing so because, well, you better go, you know, find like a dispensary down the way.
Yeah, Rob, you had something there, I think.
Yeah, I played this like 3 years ago at PAX East. It's interesting to me hearing this now because it's interesting the way that, the ways they change directions, but also despite all those changes, the way the same problems that were visible in one of those early builds are still kind of breaking the game today. Like, to be clear, I don't think, as far as like the trailer screwing them a little bit, the problem is without that trailer, what you've got is something a lot like Sir, You Were Being Hunted, right? Where yeah. Like it was, we already kind of have that like very British satire survival game. And frankly, like Sir is better at it because it is more stripped down. It doesn't have this like stealth element that We Happy Few did from the start. And right there, it was, I remember being frustrated at how swingy it was. Where, like, the feeling I think I wanted to get from a game like this, and the feeling that it sounds like maybe you were looking for a little bit, Patrick, is that, like, dystopian, you've woken up from the nightmare, and, like, you're aware of it, but you can't let anyone know. You have to, like, blend in and, like, just try to navigate the society without getting, like, caught. But there needs to be some sort of, like, twilight space between being, like, compromised and being like so far undercover that you fully blend in, basically being on
the joy. It's the game treats it as binary, and there needs to be more of a spectrum, because there are like you said, like a part of the game's premise is blending in and trying to not let folks that you've like awoken to like the reality of what you're living in. So there are like potentially interesting systems like clothing, right? And so depending on different like sort of factions or like subgroups that you're walking amongst, like there are those that in the society that actually they cannot take joy, like their bodies reject it. And rather than society working with those individuals, they just exile them from the main city hubs, and they've taken up residences in like This is like a, you know, a post-World War II sort of like bombed out sort of areas. And there are these occasional cities where things continue to thrive, quote unquote. But in these other areas, like, you can tell things have been wrecked and there hasn't been work to like restore these areas. And that's where different folks are, especially the folks whose bodies reject joy. And so you have to put on different clothes. Like, if you put on like the nice tailored suit that allows you to get by in the city, like, people are going to be hostile and suspicious to you. So in We Happy Few, you have to put on like some tattered clothes that you found. But like, that's it. Like, that's all, as far as the system goes, is like, hey, just remember to put on the suit. Like, when you go there, cool, you're done. And so, like, We Happy Few, like, its greatest, the great indictment is like not only just how much of the gameplay elements don't work. It's more that like, it's a lot of interesting ideas that aren't fleshed out to some measurable degree. It's a lot of systems that if someone pitches to you on paper, and it's why it works well in a demo or a trailer, I think, is like, oh, like, okay, I could see how this could all like work really well and like play off one another. And you just don't see a lot of that in the game. At least, you know, I put in meaningful time. Like, I put 5 to 6 hours in, like, enough to feel like I've like tried to get over any sort of like an, you know, initial humps of the gameplay and trying to understand how the systems interact. And it just didn't work for me, and I found myself fighting it in a way that was really frustrating. But I will say, like, I still don't think it was like a bad idea on Microsoft's part to pick them up. I think it's hard to tell, like, had they just chosen a path, right? Like, even if, like, if they'd gone down this Sir We Are Being Hunted path, and we're just going to make this survivalist roguelike game that has like a sort of, you know, wacky British veneer around it, maybe it would have just been a good one of those. It would have had a smaller audience, but maybe they would have pulled that part off. Or from the beginning, they decided, actually, we're going to, like, take this dystopic fantasy that we're pitching, and we're going to go full on. It's going to be a B-level Bioshock. We're not going to be able to give you the full Bioshock experience because of the resources we have, but we're going to try and give you a version of that the best that we can. And so I think, given another round, like, working with Microsoft, we can give them more resources, starting with a clear vision from the start, and probably stripping away the early access bit where maybe halfway through you end up like diverting to the whims of the reaction to a marketing trailer. They could potentially do something interesting. And Danielle, I'm curious what your thoughts have been on it so far, as someone that you know, you kind of looked at it a little bit as maybe like a walking sim to a degree, but with mechanics. I'm curious how you've reacted to your time with it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I haven't put in the same time as you have. I'm probably about an hour and a half in. I am planning to play a little bit more, but it is not grabbing me the way I kind of hoped it would grab me. I'm also playing on easy, especially after sort of hearing some of your frustrating experiences with it. I was like, I just kind of want to see what this is. I don't want to.
I don't know if you can change it mid-game, but I do know, like, I saw them on Twitter. They were pointing out that there's like a lot of granularity to the systems that I guess you can turn off.
Okay.
So I don't know if that means you could like turn off people's ability to perceive that you're like off joy, but like if I could have turned all that stuff off, I might have continued with the game. Yeah. You know, the reason I played it on the normal setting was because that's the vast majority of people are going to experience the game on the normal setting, as opposed to getting really granular about the systems, because 5 hours in you realize, actually, I don't like system X, Y, and Z. And it's probably not great that like an initial reaction to a game is like, I want to turn off some of the main systems of this game in order to keep playing it. But anyway, so you're about an hour or so in.
Yeah, something like that. One of the biggest things I've been thinking about with this game has been a couple of years ago, let's call it like a trend in the last year or two. I played a bunch of games that were sort of immersive sims, but with a little bit extra, you know, a little bit extra mechanical depth. I'm thinking about like Adrift, which is a game 2 years ago. That was very much a spacewalk simulator. You're sort of, that was Adam, I think it's, what's his name? Adam Orth's game?
Yeah, Adrift. Yeah, Adam Orth's game. Yeah.
Okay, cool. Where you are an astronaut in a falling apart kind of space station, and you're basically flying through that game, you know, in microgravity. It's basically a walking sim, but you do need to have oxygen. There are a few things kind of pushing you along. It's a light mechanical experience, but certainly had that in it. There was a game called Near Death that came out around that time that was it was set in a sort of Antarctic base where you had to stay warm, but it was largely there were a couple of other things. You had to stay warm and you had to sort of heat spaces if you're going to stay in them for any length of time. So again, kind of a walking simulator, but with those sort of light elements. Eidolon a couple of years ago. So I've seen this sort of trend of like, oh, if it was Gone Home, but with a little bit extra, you know, like a little bit more mechanical depth. And I sort of approach this as if And obviously, it was actually the opposite, you know, in hearing the story of how it was made. But it almost feels like that in a lot of ways, that like, oh, this was a story-based game that was, you know, largely about this world and this story and has this other stuff kind of grafted on. Only in this case, it came about that in the opposite fashion. And also, the mechanical stuff doesn't particularly work super well, or it doesn't feel like it works super well. And to me, it sounds very much like an issue of pacing, that like the two types of game that they are trying to graph together are opposite paced games, like a fast paced survival kind of sim where you need to be very mindful and you need to kind of be running around and going from joy dispensary to joy dispensary versus I want to, you know, be meticulous and look at all the notes and read everything and hear everything and kind of be in this world, which that's a pretty fundamental thing to kind of try to bridge. And the other thing I keep thinking about is that, man, there's a lot of stuff around World War II, sort of post-war depression and drugs and drug use here that seems like it could have been really interesting, but would have had to be handled in an extremely, extremely sort of sensitive fashion. And again, being only about an hour, hour and a half in, I'm not sure if it is. I don't know if you can speak to that at all, Patrick. Obviously, you've been playing a lot more than me, but...
No, there's been some interesting Twitter threads that have done a deeper analysis of the story based on the interviews and like their intentions. I'll see if I can pull up the one that was I got tagged in that was the most illuminating for maybe wondering, questioning some of the sort of some of the storytelling that's happening here. But I didn't get deep enough to really say too much about it. The amount that I had seen didn't set off any alarm bells, but I've certainly seen some Twitter threads that suggest that maybe there's some stuff going on in this story that would raise some eyebrows for some folks. So I'll see if I can find that Twitter account and bring it up later in the show.
Totally. Yeah, I did see some discussion in our own Discord and our own forums about that. About there was an interview. I'm not going to misquote it. Obviously, you're going to find this, but it did raise some eyebrows for sure, which is what it seemed like. All right, let's talk about another very depressing game, a depressing world. Rob, you've been playing a game I loved from exactly the era I'm talking about with those sort of walking simulators. You're playing The Final Station. Tell me a little bit about this Final Station.
Yeah, I just sort of got onto it following a while back. I edited something by Cam talking about the article about how it's this little like 2D, not quite a platformer because it's not really into jumping, but it's like a 2D exploration post-apocalyptic game. Post-apocalyptic game is the wrong phrase, actually. It's, in the middle of the apocalypse,
yes.
as it were, which is actually kind of a cool shift. But you play just like this working stiff train engineer who reports for a shift and begins taking like a commuter rail train, passing it, like you're basically like taking this Amtrak train down through this country. But what you know is it's 20 years since the first visitation, whatever the hell that means. And from the first, like, there's indication that there's an unusual interest from like government officials in like this particular train. And then when you get to the first like major hub, sort of their equivalent of like Grand Central or Penn. Actually, it's very much more Penn because it's a total hellhole, and you get on the basement, yeah. And people are being like murdered. But you go down there, and like there's like police barricades set up, and like there are people sort of being like detained on the lower levels. One person appears to have been executed, and all connecting train trips out of the city are like canceled. Like you can't go north, which is where you're coming from.
Doesn't sound great.
No, it doesn't. And so the pattern it follows is you have a little segment on a train where you overhear some conversations among passengers. And then you watch some beautiful like pixel art backdrops go by that are usually very evocative. And like often something weird will transpire there. And along the way, you have to like do little... You have to like tweak little things on your train to make sure it's all its power systems stay in balance. It's just basically you have to run up and like push a button until something turns green again, and then move on. And then the train comes to another station. It can't move on until you get a blocker code, which means you have to explore the station and the surrounding town in order to find where this little four-digit code is written. And that's where most of the action unfolds. And it's all this, I don't know, it's just, it's got simple little pixel art graphics, but like, it's moody and eerie and foreboding, and it is so sparse, it becomes like very suggestive in a strange way. Like, you know, a thing that I actually kept coming back to when I was playing it was, you know, this is way too much my frame of reference for everything, but it reminded me a lot of Roadside Picnic by the Strugatskys, yeah. Which is like all about this. Roadside Picnic is about the aftermath of like some sort of alien visitation. And it's left all these weird, like semi-magical, deeply menacing phenomena behind it that nobody understands. But everyone's created these like rules and procedures and systems for navigating that shit. And that's how sort of everyone pretends this is under control and that life can go back to normal. This world feels very much like that. It feels very much like it's bureaucratic. There's a lot of like people like really not wanting to see what's going on, really trying to like ignore the fact that, hey, things seem to be getting deeply fucked up around us. And I think it navigates that space very, very well. But it's also an interesting case of like, it's a game I wish had a little bit less game in it.
Yeah.
Hmm.
God, I'm seeing a trend here today. But
yeah, I mean, like, it's funny. I think a lot of, like, pure walking simulators that are all about, like, unobstructed but, like, really guided exploration just start to bore me. What was the, Everyone's Gone to the Rapture? Mm-hmm. Is an example of, like, a game that is beautiful, that is, like, evocative, and just does not do a lot for me because, like, for me, there's just not a whole lot there to sink my teeth into. It's a very slowly unfolding.
They should have. You needed to move faster in that game. In that game,
yeah.
You needed a skateboard.
I think they patched in like the ability to let you run faster.
And they also claimed that they're like, oh no, there's a button that lets you move faster. I don't know that.
That's your definition of faster. That you look.
Yeah.
I didn't need to move like Sonic the Hedgehog in that game, but I also needed to move faster than an actual hedgehog.
But it's weird, because like that is a game that I will often like look at and be like, look, not to be that guy, but like, if there was some sort of like thing you interacted with and had to overcome, or just like to like interact with to like understand some aspect of how this world works and like take part in that, that would be really cool. That never happens in that game. And I often think like, boy, it'd be nice if that were there. The final station has this like combat mechanics, these crafting mechanics, a lot of exploration. But after a point, I'm just like, man, I figured out the combat. Like, you don't need to keep throwing zombies at me. Like, I got it. Believe me. Like, we can just move on. Ditto the rail sections. And so it's this weird thing of like those mechanics, particularly during the exploration, help sell like the vibe and the menace of this world, and I think they're important, but at the same time they begin undercutting the experience itself, because like after they played their part it becomes very like familiar video gamey, like, okay, now do it a million more times and show you've really got it. Yeah
That's what eventually turned me off of that game too, which I loved that game. It almost made my top 10 a couple of years ago, because exactly what you're saying. That vibe is amazing. The story is really cool, and I like when super story heavy games do this well, right? I liked what sort of Tacoma was doing that was more story mechanics than it was traversal. They ended up getting rid of all the traversal stuff because, interestingly, it was getting kind of in the way of the story, which is, man, amazing how that happens. But yeah, the combat eventually, I was just like, I'm good. It just wasn't, you know, terribly interesting after a while. So this is a really tough balance. Like, if you're going to put a lot of mechanics in your game, even if it's a very story-based game, they've got to feel really good and they've got to actually really support the theme. You got to kind of work on that level as well. So, yeah. Any other thoughts about the final station?
No, I was just thinking as you were saying that, though, I think the other thing these things are good at obscuring is maybe how little is there. Sure. I'm thinking, well, like a true immersive sim, like anything from the Arcane catalog, for instance. Like, yeah, there's tons of shit in that world for you to explore, and so even if you removed all the stealth stuff and all the threat from the environment, there's still a bunch of shit for you to go around and like look at and like uncover and reveal to yourself. But also, those games are massive and have a huge amount of narrative content sort of poured into them. And even that feels like more than it probably is, because there's all this stuff sort of leavening it out and sort of making it harder for you to acquire these little bits. And I think the final station, like, I think if you took away all that stuff, you'd realize, oh, it's just a series of, like, each station has, like, two or three interesting rooms and, like, one conversation, and that's all there is to the game. And so it's this weird thing of, like, striking that balance of, like, how do you not bore the shit out of the player by having sort of your mandatory game elements become deeply repetitive versus making the entire magic trick begin to pale?
Yeah. That's not an easy question. Game design is hard. I want to hear a little bit about your experiences in Rome as well. I know that's a hard shift. It's a post-apocalypse... mid-apocalypse to ancient times.
Yeah, well, it's an apocalypse for somebody.
You know, somebody's not having a good day, yeah, right?
I don't know. So Rome 2 has been out, like, for 5 years, and they just released another massive expansion with, like, deep, revisions to the way different systems work in that game. And so it's this weird thing of, like, I think 5 years ago that game was dog shit. And they have steadily, like, made it better and tried to, like, introduce new elements. And it's weird, because we actually had this conversation 5 years ago on Three Moves Ahead. I actually, like, said at the time, this game is fucked forever no matter what they do, because after a point, you cannot patch in design. And in the intervening 5 years, it's kind of like Creative Assembly going, like, hold my beer. And
did the community reject the game, or was it, oh, or were you an outlier?
It's their biggest hit ever. Like, by far.
Whoa.
This is why they keep releasing new expansions. Like, okay. View Rome 2 as, like, a platform that they control, and it's got a massive install base that even dwarfs, I think, like, Warhammer.
Why?
I don't fully know.
Okay.
There's, like, part of it is...
Because it's not even Rome 1, it's Rome 2. Like, was Rome 1 a really big release as well? And this was just like, oh, okay, so it was skating off of an already, like, good foundation.
Yeah, like, Rome 1 is the one where they moved to a 3D engine. Like, before that, it was all sprites. And so Rome 1, to everybody, was, like, the moment that, like, holy shit, these Total War games are something. So it had that attraction. The other thing is, and my colleague on 3MA, Troy Goodfellow, actually had a good point about this. He said that, like, Rome is a topic that everybody thinks they know a little bit about. And so it's just a thing that, like, you know, as opposed to Empire, which is about, like, you know, linear musket warfare in the 1700s, a lot of people look at that and they're like, I don't know fuck all about that. Rome people think, like, well, I've seen Gladiator. Like, I'm into that shit. Like, the legions. Hell yeah. And so I think that was a big part of the appeal. They had a massive marketing blitz behind it. At the time, it was a, like, serious leap forward in, like, graphical fidelity in the game. So it was a commercial success, but also from day one, there were a lot of people who were looking at it being like, I don't know, it takes 20 minutes to, like, crunch through a turn. Like, the game ran like dog shit, where you'd hit end turn and you'd have to, like, you could read a book, I did, like, read books while I was trying to, like, review that game, because, like, yeah, like, 5 minutes to, like, cycle a turn, the games themselves are, like, 300 turns, something like that. Like,
oh,
it's a lot.
God.
Yeah. And then just a lot of the game didn't work particularly well. There wasn't very much interesting that happened. Everything took forever. It was a big game, but not a great one. So Creative Assembly's solution to this was twofold. One was to aggressively patch and optimize. And the other thing was, through DLC sets, create first more focused campaigns that didn't maybe run into the same problems as the giant sprawling, like, all ancient history in one game model of Rome 2, but also they introduced new mechanics in those campaigns. Which brings us to Rise of the Republic, which is like trying to tell the story of like early Rome, but also along the way change core things about how politics work in that game. And it's this weird, like, it's like a game trying to wear a costume of another game. Like,
It basically seems like they've wrapped a sequel into expansions.
Very much so, like partly that, but then also they're like trying to be like, we're a Paradox game. Look at us. Like, there is this political element that it, like, the menus themselves are modeled almost exactly over the menus you get in Crusader Kings 2. And they're like, we can have these interactions between family members and dynastic politics, and there's plotting, and you'll get that good, tragedy of Julius Caesar bullshit, where, like, you know, people are turning against your console, and, you know, won't that be cool? But the way it all ends up working is just you go into these menus, and it's like, you're the only player. That's the thing. Like, in Crusader Kings 2, every actor is like a little AI being that has its own agenda that it's pursuing. And in Rome, they aren't. They don't really have any of that like fictionalized inner life, but you interact with them as if they did. And so it's this weird system of like all these things that basically amount to keep these people from rebelling and like launching a civil war. And it's like a dozen different buttons with different like thematic wrappings around them that all accomplish the same thing. It's a profoundly strange thing. It's like, I will send the wife of my consul to go like on a charm offensive and win over this political party. I will press that button. But then my son, the prince, will give a gift to this other political party member. But those things both equal out to like, yeah, this faction likes you more. Like, that's it. Like, that's... Yeah. And because they like you more, your chance of there being a civil war, like, decreases. But none of those characters are actually following an agenda. It's more just like they're a meter that fills up, at which point they declare civil war, and you have to go kill everyone. That's kind of it. And that's kind of their new innovation for Rise of the Republic, is, like, introducing all these weird, like, dynastic politics that don't really do anything, but like remind you of maybe more functional strategy games.
It keeps being the theme today of grafting mechanics onto experiences that they don't want to be grafted onto.
Is it possible that like a lot of these expansions are just them sort of experimenting in a way to figure out like what Rome 3 should be?
I think so. There's definitely a history at Creative Assembly of like doing all their innovative work in the DLCs, like the major releases.
Because then in the same way, it doesn't like craft the narrative of the response to the game. It's like, oh, it's just the expansion, they're experimenting. But then it's like, oh shit, this really worked. This worked really well. Okay, like we'll go make this like the core feature of the next big release. Which seems like at this point, you know, that I don't know if it's around the corner, but it seems like, you know, 5 years later, they probably have to be pretty deep into figuring out what that third one is.
Well, I mean, the thing that it looks like is Three Kingdoms, which is pretty much around the corner. Okay. Like, I mean, that's going to be where a lot of this sort of gained knowledge is going to be used. But the weird thing is, like, in the meantime, Rise of the Republic is its own DLC, but a lot of these systems I just described are now patched into the core game. So if you go and play Rome 2, the experience it was at launch, even the game design it was at launch, basically gone. And now you're playing, like, it's very Paradox-esque, where it's like, okay, now you're playing the original game, but on the Rise of the Republic patch, and right, it has all this stuff. It's weird. You know, somewhere along the way, I do not like... I tolerate this game now. Like, I'm okay with it. I don't really love it. Like, there's a lot of Total War games I like more. It is one of my most played Total War games, because there are few Total War games that have forced me to come back again and again and be like, so are you good now? Am I going to like you? Is this going to be cool? And so, like, you know, there are, like, scores of hours into this game, and pretty much all of them are me going around being like, boy, I hope maybe this is the one where, like, they did patch in design. And each time I'm like, yeah, it's a little better. Still kind of fucked up.
I mean,
good for them for the commitment, though. I mean, you know, that's... there's a commitment to try and, I guess, fix your failures.
Dude, it's a huge game at this
from
point.
A lot of games.
Like, yeah, like right. if you just if you did like Rome 2, you've got endless Rome 2 forever that you can just play.
Endless Rome 2. That's, you know what? I saw Gladiator. Maybe I'm into that shit. I think we should take a quick break. And then, Natalie, I know you've got some excellent missives from a very happy land, unlike many of these other worlds we've been visiting today. So we'll be we will be right back.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
All right, Natalie. Hi. Am excited to hear about your life post Hollow Knight and into a beautiful, happy world. Well, maybe.
Well,
it's not the happiest world. I guess it's kind of
you can find happiness
too.
In it, is what I will say.
Yeah,
but
there you go.
The situation's pretty, it's bleak at the moment.
It's a
little
messed
up. I went back to my Breath of the Wild save. After finishing Hollow Knight, I wasn't sure what to do with myself.
Wait, did you finish Hollow Knight?
I finished.
We thought about doing a spoiler cast for Hollow Knight, and then it just kind of got away from us.
We should still do it. I really still want to do it.
But now I need
so
to finish
many,
finish it.
You should finish it because I finished it.
Okay.
And I've heard it's worth doing.
It's
Is
worth,
it worth doing.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a fun fight once you get it.
Okay. It's like what, like another like 6 or 7 hours to do the last sprint? Or not even that much, maybe.
No.
Okay.
It's really, yeah. I don't want to spoil, but
okay.
The stuff
I've heard the lore dump is worth it.
Yeah, it's cool.
Okay, all right.
It's cool.
I got some flight. I got some flights coming up. So maybe
yeah. It's definitely. It's not like I would say. There's no like big obstacles that or like big challenges you have to like over.
I just gotta collect some shit so
actually,
that I can just.
Oh,
I don't know.
No, yeah, there's the White Palace, right?
Yeah, there's the White Palace. I forgot about that.
But yo, if I have confidence in anything in myself, it's platforming games. So I'm sure it's going to be hard, but I feel like I can do it.
Yeah,
and
the
I
White Palace,
do it because
if I could do it, you could do it. Because I am not a
platformer.
That
was not what I was implying. I want to make it clear that is not what I was implying.
Right.
I just have, you know what, like there are like very few things in like my repertoire of like playing games where I'll be like, yeah, like throw this at me, and like I feel confident that I could get over
it.
And like platforming games are like the one thing I can really hook onto. So I'm excited to
could
see
it be
because
me?
I've constantly heard from people like "fuck the White Palace." And so I do want to check that out because I've heard it from multiple people.
Yeah,
being like the last major like. Yeah, a game saying like, yo, put together all the shit that we've been training you, but also in a way that maybe we haven't quite prepared you for.
Exactly.
Good luck.
That's exactly what
Man,
it is.
Post-Dead Cells Patrick is giving me an Icarus vibe. Just going to put that out there.
I know.
I want, hey,
like,
fly
close.
Me to that sun, baby. I want to get close.
Truly. There's also a side area in the White Palace that you should be sure to do.
Which apparently, from what I understand, so yeah, you like hit a wall and then find like a secret area,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
They patched that in, like that wasn't in the original White Palace.
No,
like,
it
they just
came
put in
with the one of the DLCs. I forget which one.
Yeah, they're smart developers. That Team Cherry, Hollow
yeah,
Knight. Good video game.
Very
good,
good
video game.
Very good video game.
Sorry, I didn't mean to sidetrack you.
That's
for
okay. I love talking about. I haven't been able to stop talking about Hollow Knight somehow. So. Finished Hollow Knight, and I've been trying to figure out what to play next, and obviously Patrick did his week-long run of Dead Cells last week, and I was like, this could be it. This could be the next game I play. But then there was a little voice inside me that was like, Natalie, do you really want to hurt yourself over and over and over again? Do you really want to be sad again and be mad again and... Do you want to do that? And I was like, no. So I decided I was like, what games do I have? I don't want to buy more games. What games do I have? And I have Stardew Valley, which I played a little bit of. That's been like my bedtime bed, my bedtime bed, my bedtime
it's
game.
It's your bedtime bed. It's
that's
nice.
My bedtime bed. You know, you got your a bed food bed, you got a bedtime bed. So I've been playing that for bedtimes. And then I started playing. One thing I've been playing that I didn't mention is a phone game. That okay. I've been playing a ton of.
I feel
of.
Like you're like, you, the way you're setting this up is like you feel guilt. Like yes. You feel like shame.
Yes. Oh,
like
no.
The way, you feel like, shame.
In the way you reached up to this point, you thought halfway through,
maybe I
won't talk
should
about
never.
This.
I haven't told anyone that I've been playing this game.
Oh, no.
The only person Please that knows continue. Is my boyfriend because he sees uh-huh. it because I play it right before bed. This is my actual bedtime game.
Oh, wow. Okay. So, yeah, okay. Please continue.
It's a game based on an anime.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Good.
And I don't even want to say what it is. I don't want to say because the anime
is
not great.
The
anime is not great. The politics of the anime not great.
Oh my god, it's Fleet Girls.
No, it's not. No, it's not. No, it's not.
But I'm shocked.
But
Sword Boys?
No, no, no. It's just like some big.
You
okay,
realize
what is
everyone
it?
Else is going to figure this out.
Yeah.
No, no. It's just
Gun
like,
Girl
I
too.
Mean, it's not that the politics are bad. It's just some, you know, big titty anime GF anime.
Hell yeah.
Okay.
Which, you know, I'm like, it's fine. I don't know. I'm just watching it for the lore.
Yes.
What the fuck?
The lore of.
Is that what this is?
That big titty lore. Is out there.
How
just
did the titties
it.
Get so big, though?
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
the question. That's what I'm watching this for.
There was a mutation.
There's got to be an explanation. Maybe I'll maybe in the next season.
I'm really just doing a research study.
Somewhere Austin is really upset.
Yeah,
he doesn't know why.
Well, Austin's ears are like
coffee.
Burning, and he's yeah. just mad somewhere.
He just spilled his coffee everywhere. What?
Yeah.
What? What's happening?
The diner just burned his toast.
Yep, they did.
Yeah, so I've been playing that. Which
are
I'm,
you really not going to mention what it is?
I really don't want to say because it's not great. It's
Hang
just
on,
like
almost,
a,
she big, hasn't really narrowed it
titty.
Down. Like,
untitled
what
titty game.
Problematic anime could it be?
Big titty anime game.
Untitled
oh
titty anime.
That's
what I'm putting in the show notes.
You're gonna get Profound things that are much unhelpful. Worse than
Did
I.
Did you do it in incognito mode? Did you just mess up your search results?
Oh, no.
Yeah,
oh,
you
no.
guys just really set yourself up for a fun Google suggestion for the next week and a half.
Oh, boy.
Okay, I'll tell you what it's called. It's called...
Please.
The anime is called, Is It Wrong to Pick Up a Girl in a Dungeon?
Wow!
Wait, I've been hearing
I
about
have heard,
this.
Yes, I have heard about this one.
Is it?
I don't
it's
know anything
honestly,
about it.
Honestly, it's one season, and it's like a chill... I mean, it's about this guy... His name is
uh-huh.
Bell, and yeah. he wants to save girls in dungeons. And he gets
That's
to the
noble.
Dungeon, and a minotaur shows up. This is all in, like, the first episode, so I don't
sure.
care about spoiling it. A minotaur shows up. It's very, like, Sword Art Online, but if real life. So, like, take the game world of Sword Art Online and put it to...
Okay.
Make that just the world. So
right, sure.
these
Natural.
People like live in, there's like this huge dungeon tower in the middle of the town and there's all these monsters in there and there's all the gods and goddesses exist like Hestia, Demeter, everyone's out here and they basically came down from heaven because they wanted to hang out with the humans and they started these families of adventurers. So every god has a family. And their family are, like, the adventurers that go into the dungeons, and then the dungeons get you money, which provide for your family, and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so, Bell, Minotaur, shows up when he's in the dungeon. Bell is extremely weak, he's not very good at adventuring, and he's about to die. He's like, oh, this is it, the Minotaur, this is my deserved death, I can't believe it. And then, Wallenstein... The sword princess shows up,
uh-huh.
who is like the best swordswoman in the okay. town, and she kills the Minotaur for him, and he gets covered in the Minotaur's blood, and he's looking at her, and he falls in love with her. And so basically, it's a twist. She saves him anyway.
Oh.
It's whatever. The show is whatever. The show is like probably like a 5 out of 10.
Is it whatever or is it good? Like, it's okay. You're in a safe space here. Is it good trash? Is it like delicious
it's
trash?
Like, it's like, I wouldn't say it's delicious because I, you know, there's some tasty trash out there, but it's like fun trash, I guess. I will say the fight scenes are really, really good. Like the action scenes between the adventurers and some of the monsters they face. There's some really good tension with that. So I enjoyed like a lot of the action. It's extremely horny too, which I was just like, I'm just gonna let this happen, and you know,
me and my wife get time to watch like 1.5 episodes of a show on most nights. Tonight, you know what? I'm just gonna put this on.
See what happens. It's on Crunchyroll, and Crunchyroll actually, I think, made the game for the anime, so that's how I found out about it because I follow Crunchyroll on Twitter, obviously, and they were like. How to pick up Girls in a Dungeon, the game. Download now by Crunchyroll. And I was like, yep, slam that download button.
Wow.
And so I've been playing that, and it's like it's a gacha game, but I haven't actually spent any money on it yet, because I think, I don't know, I'm still in early game, and I've been putting a lot of hours into it, so... but it still kept me coming back. I mean, you just like run through. It plays like the whole anime arc is in there. So like, as you're going through the story missions, like the whole anime arc story is in there, and it's based on a manga, I'm pretty sure. And so, but there's also like side characters that you didn't really get to know in the anime that are in the that are in the game. So just you know, for the lore,
playing
it for the lore,
for the lore. I'm gonna get that can I get a bumper sticker?
Yeah, I really want that t-shirt.
For the lore.
For the lore. So that's actually probably what I've been playing the most of.
Okay. Wow, so you essentially you lied to Danielle.
I did lie to Danielle, I'm sorry.
On the show, and then we slowly extracted the true story.
I need to apologize. I apologize to you, Danielle. I didn't want to talk about my anime trash, but
hey,
here
sometimes.
I am.
Look, it's a safe space. We talk about our real feelings here.
Thank you. Sometimes
we talk about very heavy shit on Waypoint Radio, and sometimes, you know, and sometimes you just got to be honest with yourself and your friends.
About the horny anime I'm watching.
This fan art.
You know? Exactly. I'm glad we got there. Speaking of horny anime, you're playing Breath of the Wild.
I don't know, there's some horny stuff in that game a little bit.
Look, I've seen some Prince Sidon and some...
Well, I was going to say, people are horny for parts of that game, but the game itself is not horny.
You can find some horny shit in that game.
You can find a little bit of horny in that game, but it's not
tiny,
much.
Tiny, subtle.
It's Nintendo, tasteful. They're only going to give you a little bit. You got to kind of...
Yeah, Waluigi's not in it, so,
It's not going to be as hot.
Not that much
horny. Not going to be as hot as heavy as if Waluigi was here.
Exactly.
What are you saying about Waluigi's weight?
I'm not talking about his weight. I'm talking about his presence.
Mm. All right. I'm uncomfortable.
It's a safe space.
Rob is just staring off into the distance.
I want to know where Rob's Waluigi presence.
I want to know where Rob's Google searches have gone from here. He's been very quiet for the last couple of minutes.
I'm just signing up for Crunchyroll. What can I say?
Good anime, Rob. It's a good one. You should watch it. Anyway, so I've been playing Breath of the Wild. Speaking of games and mechanics that do bad, this is one that does good.
Yes.
So that was like segue.
Okay.
Breath of the Wild hot take coming in. Actually, this game is trash.
Oh boy.
No.
Not here, so finally we can give our real Breath of the Wild takes.
I was thinking that whole time of what the segue should be for, bad mechanic meet game or bad feel between games and mechanics. And I was like, but this good feel. So that was my whole segue that
you
I was thinking
it.
About that whole time.
You know, there were some anime titties in between, but you did it.
There
you
were.
There.
You know, I got distracted.
You climbed the mountains. It's cool.
They big.
They be big. They be distracting everyone, apparently. So I'm trying to talk about Breath of the Wild. I've been playing Breath of the Wild again. And at first I started a new save because when I first tried to get back into it, I was like, how the fuck does this game work? What are all these buttons? This game...
Had you not finished it?
No, I never finished it.
Oh, okay.
So last year, I put it at number one in my... Well, I put like 50 hours into that game, but I'd never finished it.
It's decent.
So I forgot. That game has so many buttons. I forgot how many buttons that game has. The game has a lot of buttons. So I started a new save so that I could kind of like do the tutorializing again and just get back into the feel without being up against like 10,000 moblins who want to eat my soul. So I started a new save. I did the great plateau area. And then I was like, all right, I'm ready. So then I went back to my old save and I was in Gerudo Town. And the last time I played, I was very, very hesitant to do any story stuff. Because I just didn't want the game to go by too fast. So obviously, having spent so many hours in that game. So I was in Gerudo Town and I was like, ugh, I really don't want to do this electricity bullshit right now. Like, I just, this sucks. I don't like being here. I did like a couple side quests. I did the sand snow boot side quest. So after climbing that mountain, I was like, I'm done here. I need to go somewhere else. So I decided to go to the Goron Town and do that. So I went over there, I did that, and I forgot how hard the game is. I forgot that that game is hard sometimes, which was really cool to kind of come back into after, you know, playing all these hard games this year, coming back to Breath of the Wild and having, it's a hard game, but there's another way of doing it. If it's too hard, there's another way of doing it that could be a little bit easier. And it's not like, I was thinking about this, it's not gating you. Like in past Legend of Zelda games, like they would gate you from areas by like just like literally just gate, gate you. Up. Yeah. Literally just gate you. And the thing is, when you kind of enter an area that you feel like, oh, maybe I shouldn't be here, maybe I'm not strong enough, maybe I'm not whatever, like, you can still kind of be there. Like, there's always, like, a way to work around it. And I just have such a appreciation for being able to not have to kill the boss in the one way that you have to kill the boss, like, in Bloodborne or whatever. Like, I mean, I know that there's, like, cheese strats in Bloodborne. I know there's, like, other things you can do, but that's not the game. That's not the run I'm doing right now through Bloodborne. So I just have, like, such a, I don't know, it's just such a relief to be able to beat things, beat a hard breath. Things, and, like, it is truly a breath of the wild.
Yeah. Well, fresh. We just killed Patrick. He gave up. He gave up. Rob is still Googling Waluigi and anime titties.
Go back to the crib, Patrick.
Just quit. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just going to go. Yeah. Y'all ever seen it take so bad that you need to go lay down in your kid's crib, go to sleep?
God. So, yeah, No, go ahead.
I was going to say, I really appreciate that, too. It's almost a little bit immersive simmy. It's the most immersive simmy of all Zeldas. But, yeah, sorry to interrupt.
Yeah. No, it's funny that you say that because when I took that narrative of immersive, or whatever, I forgot the name.
It's like
of the
a class. Professor Sejong's Wild Sims, Ride. Right? Is that?
yes, with Matthew Weiss, who's over at the Game Center. Narrative Sim Immersion. What was it called? This is gonna bother me. Anyway,
it was a class in immersive sims.
We talked about
right?
It was a class exploring sort of the history of like narrative immersive sims. And we talked about Breath of the Wild a lot. And playing that game again, it is such an immersive sim. I mean, just the consistency and the physics and the. I mean, this is not by no means a hot take. Lots of people have been saying this since it came out, but it's just cool. It's a good game. It's such a good game. I love that game.
It really is. One of the best.
I also love the horny anime game, but, you know, those are my tastes. Those are the two.
The two genders
of
the game.
Here's Natalie's.
Yeah.
I'm the centrist in between horny anime games and Breath of the Wild. It is me. God.
Someone's got to take up the mantle.
You know? It's a heavy weight, but, you know.
It is heavy.
Oh, that's beautiful. That's so beautiful.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I'm so proud of us all. We've done good today.
Yay for Austin's week out.
He's not coming back.
When Austin's away, the horny anime will play.
That's true.
That should be the title of this episode, actually.
It was going to be.
I'm talking about his presence. That was going to be the title. I write down like possible titles as we go, but I feel like, well, Austin's, we'll see if it fits. You know, I gotta write that down.
Feel if it gets in those character count.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see. I'll play with it. Don't worry. We'll get there. We'll get to a beautiful place. I was gonna do a question, but we're actually running a little bit over, so I think we should probably just go to waypoints because I'm sure everybody has a good one.
Before we get there, I just want to mention because we didn't talk about Dead Cells. I have a lot of thoughts on Dead Cells. I'm not gonna do the Dead Cells chat now. But if you Austin was on a truly legendary stream.
Oh God,
last
that
Friday,
stream was so was good.
So many ups and downs. And actually, you want to talk
emotional.
About lore. Like, there's lore that developed out of that run. Our baby boy, the great sword. Oh, it's just,
baby broadsword.
I let him down. Baby broadsword.
That big boy.
He was such a big boy. He just got so big.
He just wanted to be
go watch
so
that
big
stream.
For you.
If you want to, it's a lot of fun. There's a lot of high drama. And Austin and I talked through a lot of our thoughts on Dead Cells. We'll sort of like reconvene when he's back next week and we'll sort of like put a cap on that. But if you're looking for us to sort of chat about that game, like a lot of that happens over the course of that stream, sort of the mechanic. I mean, the short version is a really, really fucking awesome game.
Nice.
And you should play it. And even if you're not into roguelikes, I think there's a lot that you can get out of Dead Cells, even just enjoying the combat mechanic. So yeah, short version is Dead Cells is extremely good. And go watch that stream, which the archive is currently up on Twitch, and then it'll be up on YouTube soon enough.
Yep, there's one going up today.
Awesome.
Day one. So get started. There will be one going up every day this week. So if you want to relive the sort of anticipation, just every day.
If you want to watch a pro gamer.
There you go.
The true gamer.
The true gamer will emerge
Gamer Nation.
Over the course of that week. Gamer Nation, rise up, hashtag RYSE. You know what? We all like that Xbox One launch game. Actually, that game was all right. It was better than most people gave it credit for.
Got a real Seriously. Order 1886 situation with that one.
Yeah.
I never played that. I heard that game had real
good
visuals.
Damn good game.
Yeah, I know. I kind of mean to go back to it at some point. Anyway.
Waypoint 101, maybe. One day. We'll see. You know. Just putting that out there.
Yeah, Waypoint 101. You know what? I don't usually do the Waypoint 101s because they take like 12 hours to like play those games.
That was like a 6-hour game, right?
The order's pretty short. I could probably fit that in.
Nice.
I'm down.
There we go. Sometimes on the podcast, we do our best brainstorming.
You know, tell Austin, we already figured out the next Waypoint. It's the mediocre but kind of surprisingly good PlayStation 4 launch game.
Oh, yeah.
What if Vampire was condensed to just like 5 minutes?
There you go.
Perfect. All right. So, Rob, what's your waypoint?
Oh, no. You don't get to be like, I get to go last because I'm the host. You
want
to
be like, I'll go first.
Yeah.
I'll go first. You want me to go first? I'll go first. I watched The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus for the first time on Friday.
That sounds really familiar.
What is that?
It was Heath Ledger's final film. It's a Terry Gilliam, wild, weird, super trippy fantasy movie about a guy with psychic powers who kind of runs around in a carny roadshow sort of thing in the modern UK. And he and his daughter and their buddy, who's a young guy, sort of have this show. And in the show, people can go inside the mind of Dr. Parnassus. He can like project them into like an astral realm where they experience their fantasies, basically. And Heath Ledger plays this sort of con man guy who has amnesia for half the movie, who sort of gets involved. I won't spoil anything. It's a wild, trippy movie. It's a little bit of a mess, but I really, really enjoyed it. It was visually amazing. Really, really kind of incredible. Reminded me a little bit of... it fits in very much with the sort of adventure... Was it Adventures of Baron something? Manchurian, I think, and Time Bandits. Yeah, okay. It kind of fits in with those kinds of movies and a little bit of Brazil, although less about sort of the structural fucked upness and bureaucracy of the world and much more about kind of like making art for a world that doesn't care for your art anymore in a lot of ways.
An interesting thing about this movie, Heath Ledger died during the filming of the movie.
The production of this movie is fucking fascinating.
It's amazing.
Just go read the, if you don't watch the movie, read the Wikipedia article on how they salvaged this movie.
It's incredible,
from not being released, yeah.
Yeah, it's really, really incredible how they do it. Very, very briefly, I won't go into all of it, but there's a lot of scenes where, because it's happening in a sort of astral projected realm, Heath Ledger's character is played by various other sort of Hollywood superstars like Johnny Depp and Jude Law and Colin, what is his name?
Farrell?
Yes, Colin Farrell sort of take on his role, and they actually they weren't credited. I mean, they're obviously super, super recognizable superstars, but they weren't credited in the movie, and they gave apparently all their earnings to Heath Ledger's daughter. They sort of worked for free and gave their earnings to her, which is kind of cool. It's fascinating. It's a fascinating movie. Again, a little bit of a mess, but I really loved it. I really, really enjoyed what it was doing. So that's my waypoint. It's from about, oh God, like 9 years ago. Yeah. 2009.
Has it been that long?
Yeah. It's been a while since.
What is time?
That movie actually asked that question in a lot of interesting ways. But speaking of time, I suppose, who wants to go next?
I can.
All right.
Awesome. I will recommend. I am generally anti-horror television because I don't think it works in the medium very well due to commercial breaks. I think it often horror requires tension over like an extended period of time, and like television by its very nature and the fact that you can't control the kind of commercials you're going to get end up like really breaking like the immersion of like being in a world like that. So. I think like horror, like television works best when it's, something like The Asterisk, Evil Dead, or whatever that like television series that they did, where it's more comedic, right? Like it's more of a horror flair to something that's a little more lighthearted, seems to work better in TV. But, that's not true if you're like watching it without the commercials. And, I had heard over time that The Exorcist television series was actually surprisingly good. I had written it off because, Why would you make a television series based on The Exorcist? Like, that just doesn't, like, it just seemed exploitative, and that it was Fox looking on the shelf. I don't know. We own the rights to that. Like, go, like, The Exorcist, didn't need a television show. And so I sort of just kind of wrote it off and ignored it. Because Fox has, like, a weird history. Like, I don't like a lot of the stuff on Fox that is, like, the genre work, because it tends to be pretty shitty. But I had heard from enough people that you should check it out, and I recently signed up for Hulu with no commercials because Castle Rock was on there, and so me and my wife watched a couple episodes of the Exorcist television series, and it is really, really good. It is extremely well done. It is scary. It is tense. I highly recommend getting the Hulu version without commercials. It's only a couple dollars more, because the breaks in Hulu aren't that bad, but like it's worth the extra couple bucks to like just remove that as an element of surprise. But yeah, it does. Like, it draws out an exorcism in the way that I was not expecting. You know, it does a lot more family drama and in a way that feels very natural. Like, it gets a lot of, like, the politics of, like, the church. And it's just, it's surprisingly well done. And I highly recommend checking it out. I've heard the second season is better than the first season. I've heard it has a problem where it ends on a cliffhanger and it was canceled. So that's a frustrating part of watching the show. But, four episodes in, and there are only 10 episodes. It's also my problem with, like, shows that show up on like mainstream television, it's like it's got to be 23 episodes, and you know, it ends up ruining a lot of stuff like that. But 10 episodes, it's really tight, and I it's genuinely scary. So I actually highly recommend The Exorcist television series, and you can stream it on Hulu.
Hell yeah. One day I'll have to ask you to watch Channel Zero and see what you think of it.
I watched the first couple episodes of the first meet, the one with the stairs that go into the sky.
Yeah.
We watched the first episode of that. Really liked it. Just haven't gotten back around to it.
Totally.
It's also on Hulu, I think.
I think so. Yeah. I think I just got it on Amazon, but yeah. That one's... Yeah. Sorry.
No, you're right.
I did a double.
It's on Amazon. Amazon Prime.
Sorry. Yeah. So excited about horror. All right, Rob, are you ready?
Yeah. All right. Ooh, Channel Zero looks cool.
It's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a creepypasta television series.
Yeah, there's three series already.
Legends.
I think the second one's the best, but all right, I'll stop. That's for another day.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Rob.
Yeah, so this weekend, you know, it was, I mean, first of all, it was like a gray and rainy weekend for the first time in ages. Like, the heat broke. So that meant it was time for, like, old black and white movies to an extent, like preferably suspense movies. So I fired up, I decided let's have a good old time. Let's watch Gaslight, directed by George Cukor, right, and starring Ingrid Bergman and Charles Boyer. And it is indeed it's a good movie. It was a lot of fun is the wrong word, though. It is a deeply uncomfortable movie. Uncomfortable because it is such a good portrait of like a shitty manipulative marriage and the dynamics at work in it. And because like you know that like a lot of stories like this, the text is going to be or was somewhat misinterpreted by its audience, who view it as like, ah, it's the movie where like the husband tries to convince his wife like she's going insane so he can like do whatever the fuck he wants. But like really the means by which he does that are all these like familiar tropes of like things that bad couples, and particularly men, like do thoughtlessly in relationships routinely, right? Just like the entire conceit of this movie is Ingrid Bergman was a child in the care of like this famous opera singer in like late 1800s London. And she was strangled by like a serial strangler, but nobody knows why. And like, there's never any resolution to the case. But she goes off, she leaves London behind her, and she tries to take up opera singing. But along the way, she ends up falling in love with this pianist, Charles Boyer. And they get married. And he's like, I've always had this dream of like living in a beautiful English townhouse. And she's like, well, I have one. It's the one where my aunt was murdered, but what the hell? It's your dream. Let's make a go of it. And from the minute they get there, like the guy turns on a dime and starts gaslighting. It gets his name from the fact that like routinely, the lights in the house just all go down and she's the only one who notices. And when they go down, that means like somebody has opened up a gas valve somewhere else. Like someone is in another room at night using the light and nobody else notices. And she keeps saying like, hey, this is happening. But everyone thinks, well, she's already like, there's this history of fabulism. And like, he's going around telling everybody like, you know, she's very unwell. She can't. And it's uncomfortable because it is like, Ingrid Bergman turns in a hell of a performance in this movie, down to like all the ways she begins to second guess herself in like really convincing ways. Like she comes across very well as not a broken person, but someone who's been made deeply insecure by the feeling that she's always going to do something wrong and cause everything to turn against her. It's very uncomfortable. But it's also, like, really richly atmospheric in the way movies of that period are. It's all London fog, and Charles Boyer plays this, like, well, he doesn't have a mustache, but if he did, it would be long and twirly. so, like, you know, he, like, plays up his accent so that, the way he speaks to her even becomes, like, this almost, like, crack of doom where he's like, Bola, you're imagining things. Like, it just keeps getting more and more sinister. And then Joseph Cotten is for some reason there, just to be a handsome, charismatic American working for Scotland Yard to sort of ride to the rescue. But it comes to a really, it's a movie about the ways that people do not listen to women, the way women, the minute they are married, become like stripped of all their power and agency, and like societal convention basically puts her in the keeping of her husband, even though in terms of social status, economic status, like, Bergman's character brought everything to that table, but he is still like her master and the master of the house. And then the ways that he manipulates also like the class system to further isolate her. It's an interesting movie. I think where it really falls down, and I think you'd make a really different one if you made it today, is that she gets a little bit of catharsis, but and it's still worth watching because of the performances and because just the overall vibe. But what she doesn't do is like any kind of saving of herself. And yeah. I think you'd probably like just want that resolution if you're making the movie today. But more to the point, I think you don't even, setting aside the agency, you don't necessarily get even a lot of like her realizing that all of this has happened. Like she does by the end, but she's second guessing herself almost until the last frame of the movie. And you're kind of sitting there waiting for her to be like, put all the pieces together and like have that usual suspects moment where it's like, wait, this was all fucked up from the start. And the movie doesn't quite deliver that. And instead it sort of foregrounds Joseph Cotton's character. The other thing I'll say about this movie, fantastic men's leisure wear of the 1800s. Like, if you like smoking jackets, like this movie's got you covered. There are some questionable ones as well, but overall, like, beautiful.
Nice. Fascinating contrast with My Fair Lady from last week, too.
But both George Cukor.
Yeah. Very, very interesting.
He's a really, I think he's also a Philadelphia story, too, right?
Yes, pull that he up. Is.
So Cukor's an interesting one. So he was closeted gay director in classic Hollywood, but became known, I think, perhaps because like he had that reputation as being a great director for women. Katharine Hepburn loved to work with him.
Melodramas, yeah, absolutely.
And he makes good movies, but a lot of his movies also have a weird, like Philadelphia Story is the really clear one. Philadelphia Story is a deeply misogynistic movie. That is a movie that is literally about like, man, Katharine Hepburn's just a fucking bitch who doesn't know her place and, like, literally opens with, like, Cary Grant just, like, throwing her to the ground. And that is a movie that's like, haha, awesome, real battle of the sexes here. And that's, like, kind of George Cukor's baby, and that was a really popular movie. So it's weird. Like, on the one hand, you get, like, sort of a proto-feminist work like Gaslight. But then you also get the Philadelphia Story, which is 100% like basically justifying why women don't get believed, why women like get shut down and controlled. It's a problematic body of work, but it's an interesting one and one that provides some interesting insights into the changing gender politics of the era.
Absolutely. I'm always so excited when you bring up classic movies, because that was such my bread and butter for a very long time, so.
Well, you can watch it on Filmstruck. So it's a service that I'm coming around to more and more. Like, the film transfers are real good. It's a blast.
Nice. Thank you. All right, Natalie, I'm letting you have the last word because you brought such beautiful, you know, anime titty discourse to this podcast. So what is your waypoint?
Is that what I'm going to be known for? Is that my place in the podcast now?
Many, many things. Oh, so many things.
There's always a lighthouse. There's always a Danica.
There must always be a Danica.
Yeah, oh, just... no.
That's funny that you watched that this weekend, Rob, because I watched The Aviator this weekend.
All right. Yeah.
Which I didn't finish. I watched two movies this weekend. I didn't finish either of them. The first was The Aviator because it was so fucking long and depressing. And honestly, just its depiction of OCD was a little too like, wow, that could be me if I wasn't taking the things I take every day. But the other thing that I watched this weekend in deep contrast, which was Mamma Mia.
Oh, yeah. All right.
Which I also did not get to the end of. But that was... I tried to get my boyfriend to sit through the whole movie, and he's not a musical fan.
The first one or the one in theaters right now?
One. I was watching the first one to prepare myself for Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again.
Here We Go Again. Okay.
So I was watching the first one, and Ben checked out after like probably like 30 to 45 minutes. He like went to go do work, so it wasn't just like he was, you know, whatever.
All right.
And then when I got like 45 minutes in, I was like, oh god, this is so cringy. God, how do I make it through this? This is just everyone's dancing. I hate this so much. Why?
Okay. Here's my question. This thing was really popular. My parents got super into it. It was a breakout hit as musicals go. What's it actually about? Like, what's cringy about it? Like, it's just ABBA songs, right? Like, what's the framing?
The ABBA songs are great. It's about, I've seen the movie before.
Yeah.
So just this watch, I didn't finish it. But basically, Meryl Streep is Donna, who is a hotel owner on this tiny little island in Greece. And the hotel is, like, you know, decrepit, it's falling apart, whatever. Donna has a daughter named Sophie, who's getting married at the age of 20 years old. And Sophie is getting married because she feels like she needs to stay with her mom, Donna, and stay. So she wants to get married, she wants to settle down and stay on the island with her mom and take care of her mom. Sophie's never met her dad. Sophie found the story opens up with Sophie finding a diary of her mom's about a summer 20 years ago, in which Sophie, remember, is 20 years old. A summer 20 years ago in which Donna had three summer flings. And so the whole story is about basically Sophie contacts these three men.
Wait, does she think they're her dads? Them.
Yes.
Okay.
She contacts these three men, invites them all to the wedding, doesn't tell her mom. Her mom sees them. Drama ensues. And I forget which one classic ends up being Sophie. The real dad.
Yeah, classic Sophie.
Sophie! And I forget which one. It's funny because all of them have, like, traits that, like,
no shit.
Sophie identify.
Like there's, like, three distinct archetypes of, like, dude that, like...
Well, first of all, you gotta say the actors who play them, because I feel
it's
part of it.
Pierce Brosnan. Stellan Skarsgård. What's his name? Yeah, that guy. And fucking Colin, your boy.
Colin Firth.
So
there you go.
There you go. Pierce is extremely hot. So is Colin. Yeah. Not sold on the third guy, but I see the appeal.
Skarsgård is like a type.
Yeah, he's a type. So yeah, and then I forget what happens next, but basically at one point they're all like, oh, are we the dad? Have you ever met... One of them was like, where is your father, Sophie? And Sophie's like, he could be here. I don't know. And then they're like, huh? And then they all kind of are like, I'm the dad. And then I forget what happens next, but that's where I cut off when everyone was like, I'm the dad. So that's where I was like, I'm good. I don't need to know.
Do you remember?
I'll probably finish it. I don't remember who the dad is. I don't remember what happens. But the last thing they said was that they're all walking her down the aisle. So I'm not sure how that's going to play out. I'm sure there will be some...
Probably humorously.
Humorous quarreling that goes down with paired with a great ABBA song. So,
but is it just cringy because it's like so by the numbers? Or is it like...
The cringy is like the over-the-top sort of like reaction acting in the like, I don't know. I just did a big motion with my arms, but
you also had the voice, so that it'll play. Yeah. Yeah.
It's like that. It's like, whoa, am I going to fall off this roof? No, I'm fine. And then it's like, oh yes, I did. I don't know. It's just like, that's cringy. And then there's also like, just the musical numbers. I hate seeing like 30 people dance in unison. It just cringes me out.
Why did you watch your musical? Jesus. I got terrible news for you about that genre.
I love this. Yeah.
I just wanted to watch some good vibes. I wanted to watch some good vibes. I just wanted, it was like the same thing with Breath of the Wild. I just wanted some like nice, you know, good vibes. And then, I don't know. I got sad because I missed my mom, and then it was just too much. I couldn't do it. And then the dancing, I couldn't do it.
So I'll say this. Like, I think The Aviator's fine. I think there's some good stuff in it. It is really fucking long. It's from the Scorsese and DiCaprio's Quest for an Oscar collection.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
Which they got for the weirdest one.
Yeah. Though DiCaprio was very good in The Departed, I would say. Yeah. But The Aviator's fine. But there's no day in which I would not rather just watch The Rocketeer, which I think is largely a really similar movie in terms of beats, but like way more fun.
So happy.
I'll have to bring that up.
I may not make an honest buck, but at least I ain't a two-bit Nazi.
Yep.
Best line.
The patriotic mafiosi.
Best line from The Aviator. Best line from that movie. Wow. Thank you, Natalie, for taking us on that journey. That was a very, very fun journey to go on.
I love to tell
you.
Stories of other stories that already exist.
No, it was really good.
I'm a retellers.
It was fun. That was super fun. I really enjoyed it. It's like the streaming of movies, like, you know, and you recap.
I'm Netflix.
You are. Yes. It's perfect. All right, everybody. I think that's going to pretty much do us for today. Mamma Mia. That's what Mario says sometimes.
Here we go again.
Here we go again.
Yes. If you have questions, please send those to gaming@vice.com with the subject question. We are on Twitter at Waypoint. We are on Facebook at Waypoint Vice. We are on Twitch at twitch.tv/waypoint. Sorry, this is written a little differently. I keep my show notes a little different. These are Austin's show notes, so I'm just telling you what's going on here. Where can people find you online, Patrick?
At Patrick Klumpik.
Awesome. How about you, Rob?
At Rob Zachney.
How about you, Natalie?
At Natalie Watson.
Fantastic. You can find me at Danielle R.I., and of course, we always do the shout outs to Bowen for the track Miss You off the EP Pale Machine. You can find out more about Bowen at waypoint.zone/BOEN. And you can also read everything we write at waypoint.vice.com. Did it. We got through it. We got through Monday's podcast, everybody. Thank you so much. And I always will remind you to be good and be good at it. Peace.
We tried to retire the horny. Like, and I thought we had, and then comes bouncing back
Austin's
along with
here.
Natalie. Just here
Austin's
we go.
Austin's not here.
I can't not do it. I'm
oh,
sorry.
Yeah.
It's
Breath
am.
Of the Wild, huh? I've been playing some of that.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.